KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
There's an impression that Canadians often have that we would be at risk if we attempted to make our law more progressive.
I mean, they played around with ideas of bringing people back from the dead and all that, but the idea of calling them zombies, as I understand it, sort of got ushered in during that era of the 1920s.
With Windows 8, what we've done is actually reimagine Windows, and we've reimagined essentially the whole PC industry.
Coming up this hour on the program, we're going to talk about Microsoft. A big week for Microsoft, as you well know, and last week as well, with Michael Parks, Robert Horton, and you, the scariest movies. That's part of our continuing homage to Halloween. The scariest movies you have ever seen. But we start with Vaughn Palmer, who's probably got some scary news for us about Canada and the United States, right, Vaughn?
You didn't ask, but The Exorcist, obviously.
Is that right for you?
God. I slept with a light on for about 3 months after seeing it. Saw it in a theater in Toronto that was over a subway station and couldn't figure out why the theater kept shaking.
Oh, that's good.
Anyway, so yeah, we're watching the American election, as I'm sure Americans are passing attention to it. Couple of things that are pretty important, I would say. Obviously, the outcome will determine at least the speed at which the Keystone pipeline proceeds. Mitt Romney says he would approve the pipeline carrying Alberta oil to Texas on day one. I'm not sure he can do that, but the Canadian oil industry is pretty happy about that promise.
He's going to have a very busy day one, Mitt Romney.
Yes, a very busy day one. Frankly, I think there's from my reading of the American situation, there's a chance that President Obama would go along with it as well, now that they've addressed one of the major environmental concerns, namely the route through the Sandhills in Nebraska. They moved the pipeline route. So
yeah, they moved it so it wouldn't, according to the people who are critics, it would not affect the water table underneath.
Yeah. So that's that one. Here in our region, though, I think on election night, there'll be a lot of attention in British Columbia paid to Initiative 502 in Washington.
This is the legalized marijuana initiative.
Yeah, the marijuana one, because, you know, there's a group here in British Columbia called Stop the Violence BC, which is basically a legalized marijuana group. The reference to Stop the Violence is to the horrific drug wars we've had here and the violence we've had associated with it in British Columbia and the all the money. And a feeling here that one of the leaders of the group is a former Attorney General of British Columbia, Jeff Plant, and you know he said several times that, and we just heard him in that clip earlier, one of the things that always gets thrown at groups in Canada seeking to legalize marijuana or decriminalize it is, well, we can't do anything until the Americans do something because of the snarl that would result at the border if the two countries' drug laws were that divergent. Well, if Washington takes a step in the direction of decriminalization with Initiative 502, that will make the argument easier on this side of the border as well.
And is there the kind of support over on the other side of the border that we have seen on this side or appear to be seeing on this side?
Yeah, I mean, what you see again and again is that prohibition hasn't worked, that decriminalization is supported by the public, but a recognition that, you probably couldn't proceed unilaterally on this, although in a way, and I mean, I recognize that Washington in Washington State, face a struggle with your federal government over this, just as British Columbia does with our federal government on decriminalization. But, you know, I think if you go back over the history of prohibition of alcohol, prohibition fell incrementally. It wasn't something that just happened one day. It fell apart over a period of time. And for that reason, I think the Washington State vote will be looked at closely in both countries as a possible pointer to the future.
That is what I hear people saying.
Yeah.
That's what they
and
see
it is expected to pass, right, Steve?
Well, right now, the polls are showing it ahead, but We'll see, right? We always have to see. You know, Vaughn, sure. I was wondering about something. For a long time, we've looked at the cross-border traffic, marijuana from Canada coming into Washington State, people carrying it over mountain passes and through the forest. Also, the border traffic because of drugs, including marijuana, feeding a weapons trade with feeding the gangs that are north of the border. Any discussions about what a legalized marijuana system might look for movement back across the border of drugs from here to Canada?
Well, I think it could have a huge impact. I mean, the police here in Canada, in British Columbia, say that the illicit marijuana production is massive. There have been some estimates suggesting it's a bigger cash crop than any legal agricultural product produced in British Columbia, which is saying something. There's a lot of money associated with it. There's a lot of violence. And, you know, you put those two things together, and what you also get is a lot of illicit cash and corruption. There have been police reports suggesting that the money is laundered through casinos in British Columbia by, you know, being disguised as winnings. I know there's concerns, I've heard them when I've spoken in Bellingham, about illicit real estate transactions, about big chunks of legitimate property being owned by essentially drug cartels. So I think it could have a huge impact. We know from other experiences that organized crime, when it loses one product or one product stops being a major source of cash, tends to move to other things. But, you know, I realize that's one of the arguments used against decriminalization, that all you just get is an illicit cross-border trade in heroin or crystal meth or whatever. Well, all that stuff happens anyway. So I'm not sure you wouldn't just undermine one very large chunk of the business.
All right. Vaughn, you know, speaking of that, there's economic considerations that Canadians are figuring. U.S. economic stability is an issue. Coming at a time, this election comes at a time when the reports are just out that Canada's economy shrunk a little bit because oil and mining shrank a little bit. Manufacturing as well declined a little bit. What do Canadians see when they look at the U.S. economy right now?
Well, they're very much hoping that the signs of recovery in the housing market hold. That would be very good for, obviously, for our lumber industry. We have a softwood lumber agreement, trade agreement across the border that's been extended to 2015. So we're not going to be fighting about that right away. And Canada has managed to diversify its resource trade with other countries, a lot more trade, including in lumber, with China. But it would be welcome for the American economy to come back. And in that sense, Canadians will be rooting for whoever wins the election next week. The stakes are not huge for Canada in these circumstances. Canada, even though Stephen Harper, our prime minister, ideologically is probably closer to Mitt Romney, he's had good relations with Barack Obama and the Democrats, in large measure because Obama is so popular in Canada that a prime minister who makes deals with the United States is not subject to the kind of attacks that Canadian prime ministers were subject to when they dealt with the Bush administration or when they dealt with the Reagan administration. I mean, there have been opinion polls here suggesting, you know, I think the only province, well, the best province in Canada, in the most recent opinion poll that came out, the best province in Canada for Mitt Romney is Alberta. And even there, 50% of Albertans said they would vote for Obama if they had a vote, and only 19% said they would vote for Romney. So, you know, either way, the outcome of the election next week in the United States is not going to put huge pressures on Canada. It is not seen as the kind of high-stakes contest we had, say, when Bush was president, where most Canadians were totally opposed to Bush.
How was the search for a Romney supporter on Vancouver Island going?
We still haven't found one. He or she must be out there somewhere. No, I mean, you know, and this is, I've said before to you, Steve, it's not surprising. I mean, Canadians would have elected Walter Mondale, John Kerry, and what's his name, the guy who ran against Bush won.
Dukakis.
Yeah, I'm just kidding.
Oh.
Anyway, but, you know, so you look around for issues. I mean, Canadians follow American elections very, very closely. You look around for issues that will be won. There's another one, too, in Michigan, the interesting one.
This is an infrastructure question.
Yeah, so Michigan and the province of Ontario, the North American automobile industry, runs in both countries, and there are plants on both sides of the border, and goods are shipped back and forth, and parts and cars are assembled. And there's a single bridge, really, called the Ambassador Bridge, which is privately owned, linking the two countries. The thickening of the border in the wake of 9/11, the rise of cross-border trade, the long lineups, has led to an initiative to build a second bridge between Michigan and Ontario at the River Windsor in Detroit. Canadian government and the governor of Michigan has signed an agreement for it to go ahead. A private company would build it, and according to the agreement, there'd be no cost to taxpayers. But there's an initiative in Michigan mounted and financed by the owner of that private bridge, calling for a statewide referendum on the second bridge. And the referendum campaign, as I said, has been apparently pretty effective down there. It's suggested to Michigan taxpayers the money could be better used for services. It's suggested to Michigan taxpayers they might be left holding the bill for the debt on the second bridge. And you've seen Canadian authorities going down there and trying to gently dispute what they see are the myths on this. From Canada's point of view, that bridge is absolutely critical to our economy because it's one of the things that keeps, that allows the auto pack to function, that allows the Canadian branch of the automobile industry to function at a very high level.
The reading about it, the owner of the bridge, the supporters of that have implied that it'll be Chinese steel that will be used in the construction. That's a good one. I mean, just, you know, that kind of attack. Also, he spent close to $30 million on this bridge ballot campaign. How much would the bridge cost?
I don't know the price on the bridge, but that's a big crossing. That would be a very expensive bridge.
So I guess $30 million, that's nothing compared to...
Well, and the bridge is a cash cow, right? I mean, he bought it, or actually I think his father bought it way back in the 1930s, and it's been a cash cow for the family for a long time. Canadian government tried to buy it off him at one point. No! So anyway, we're now trying to get a second bridge built and a second crossing, and it would be dedicated for commerce, so that, you know, not so much for tourism and commuters. And anyway, we'll see how it goes. We'll be watching that one next Tuesday night for sure.
We will know the answer by next Wednesday for sure. All right, Vaughn, you guys had a earthquake off the coast of the Queen Charlotte Islands. How did you weather it?
Saturday night, pretty chilling initial report, 7.7 quake off the Charlottes and a tsunami warning. Bit of controversy here in BC because it looks as if the Alaskans got the tsunami warning out before the BC government did, so that's a bit embarrassing. And of course, Steve, this won't surprise you, our newspapers, our radio, and our television are full of articles about how we need to prepare for the big one and how we're not really prepared for the big one. And, you know, you could just dust off all those stories we ran after the Japanese quake or the Nisqually quake. I'm sure you've got them all in your files down there, just ready to go the next time we have a big one.
Do you have your kit by your house, Vaughn? You have the water and the flashlights and the battery?
You?
You know, I do because my wife is really organized on that. If it was up to me, of course, no.
Yeah. No, I'll be reduced to eating nuts and berries and begging in the streets.
Oh, let's hope that.
Also, I'm
happen.
In the. I will remind you as well that I am in a building here. I'm talking to you right now from a building that has been designated as one of the least earthquake-proof buildings in all of British Columbia. A giant, half-empty brick building with giant wooden timbers right over my head that would be reduced to a heap of rubble in the event of an earthquake.
Can't we get somebody to retrofit that?
My plan is to not be here.
I think that's the way to go.
Yeah.
All right. By the way, I looked it up. $3.5 billion to build the bridge, and that would create 10,000 to 15,000 jobs, it said.
Yeah, no, it's a big deal to Canada. I mean, it's a big deal to the United States, too. And because of the way the automobile industry works so well together across the border, it's as big an economic incentive to state of Michigan, ultimately, as it is to the province of Ontario, because the automobile industry sort of is so integrated that, you know, they, as I say, they run a just-in-time inventory system across the border so that parts leave the United States in the morning, they're put into cars in Ontario in the afternoon, and vice versa.
Interesting. All right, Vaughn, leave us to talk again tomorrow, and scary movies, The Exorcist, that's the one for you.
Off you go.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.
It's 10:20. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information. I'm Andy Hurst. In 2008, the youth vote was instrumental in electing President Obama. So how influential will the youth vote in this election cycle be? We'll take an in-depth look at the issue this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College, a four-year public college in Olympia, where students are challenged to unlock their passion for learning in small, theme-based classes. Information available from representatives at fall college fairs and online at evergreen.edu/welcome.
Clouds and showers, 56 degrees right now in the U District. We're expecting a high today of 58. Forecast calls for clouds and showers the rest of today. Same goes for tonight and tomorrow. Clouds and rain. Tonight's low in the low 50s. Tomorrow's high in the upper 50s.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The lobby people have been devoured by monsters and scary films, Robert Horton. The lobby people, we go out to the lobby and we'll just be getting blood-soaked popcorn behind the candy counter.
There was an unfortunate incident in the lobby.
Very scary.
The snack bar is closed.
Robert Horton is a film critic, longtime contributor to this fine radio station. You can find his reviews in the Everett Herald and at his blog, The Crop Duster. The Crop Duster got like a Halloween motif today at your blog?
No, but I have been running old reviews from the 1980s of horror movies on my other blog, which is called What a Feeling, which is reviews that I wrote in the 1980s. So there's a bunch of Friday the 13th Part 5 and Poltergeist 3 and also some good ones.
Who is in Friday the 13th Part 5? Can you name any actors?
I cannot. Okay. Possible that somebody, a couple of those people went on to other things, but it was pretty grim.
All right, so we thought we'd have a little call-in for Halloween. Scariest movie you've ever seen. I was trying to remember what the scariest movie for me was, and I do remember being kind of freaked out as a young boy by Village of the Damned, with all those kids with white hair and white makeup and kind of pink or orange eyes. I don't know that it was all that scary, but it sticks in my mind.
It's
and I know
scary.
Freaked out, didn't want to watch it. And then Darby O'Gill and the Little People, which you say is not really a scary movie.
No.
But there was a creepy leprechaun in that film.
Yeah, yeah.
He was not a good person, that leprechaun.
Well, it's an example of one of those movies that's scary, but it doesn't mean to be.
Yeah.
But if it hits you at the right place when you're a kid.
No, what about you?
Well, also, it's Village of the Damned was in black and white.
Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Village of the Damned, yeah.
It's interesting that you remember the...
The glowing eyes.
Of the eyes.
It's just in my head,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, that's the way that works, yeah.
That's cool.
Creepy little possessed kids, though, that can be scary.
Yeah.
It can be very, very scary.
Yeah, wasn't that... I never saw them, but The Omen? No, I saw The Omen. Gregory Peck.
Yeah.
And then Damien, they made a movie about the kid later.
They made a few... few sequels.
But The Omen was kind of freaky. And, of course, Rosemary's Baby, a little freaky.
Yeah.
That was a freaky
movie. The kid didn't come along until the final scene, but yeah. Still, oof.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are you? Scary movie for you?
Well, going back to the source, I just, I remember being frightened by the Wolfman when I was a kid.
The original Wolfman.
Yeah, which seeing it on TV and thinking that there was some, I would worry when I went to bed that the Wolfman might come along.
Well, good reason. We, you know, because we...
you never know.
We pre-taped, no, we didn't pre-tape, we vetted some of these. So here's a little clip from the Wolfman.
Werewolf? What's that?
Well, that's a human being who at certain times of the year changes into a wolf.
You mean runs around on all fours and bites and snaps and bays at the moon?
Oh, even worse than that sometimes.
What big eyes you have, Grandma.
Little Red Riding Hood was a werewolf story. It was an old poem. Even a man who is pure in heart and says his prayers by night may become a wolf when the wolfbane glooms and the autumn moon is bright.
Yes, but what's this pentagram business?
Every werewolf is marked with that and sees it in the palm of his next victim's hand.
Look, lady, if you're trying to scare me out of here, you're not getting very far.
Oof.
I don't know. I was thinking this was not very scary until the thing about the pentagram in his hand.
Let me tell you, that's scary.
Was that Lon Chaney?
Lon Chaney Jr.
Jr.?
Yep, as the man who becomes a wolf. And something about that bit of doggerel in there, the poem, was something that I, as a child, I wrote that down in my notebook because I wanted to remember it.
Wow, you're going to be a film critic when you're just a little kid.
Yeah, and the seeds were sown. And I think that one of the reasons the Wolfman and other werewolf movies have been successful is that they have a certain lore about them. You know, supposedly these folk poems have been said, as suggested there, and there's a pentagram involved. And as we find out later, there's silver bullets that might need to be used and all this imagery and the full moon, of course. And somehow that all was, you know, kind of convincing. It helped you think that, gee, maybe there is this mysterious thing out there that has, I mean, why would there be all these folk tales about it if it weren't true and all that stuff? Although it's the funny thing is that even though werewolves have been rumored for many centuries in folklore, a bunch of the specific stuff that we think of as werewolf stuff was invented by the screenwriter of that movie, Kurt Siodmak, who had a long career as a writer. And
was that the same guy who was a director later?
Well, his brother, Robert,
his brother. Robert
Siodmak was a very well-known director of film noir. They were both immigrants from Middle Europe. And Kurt also, he wrote a great novel. Well, I don't know if it's a great novel, but he wrote a novel called Donovan's Brain.
Yes, saw that movie.
Yeah, and it's been adapted many times. It was a bestseller, and it's a very popular idea. It's actually it's a fun book. I read it once.
That's great. Robert Horton handed me this book that he said influenced him a great deal, A Pictorial History of Horror Movies. What year is this book?
I'm going to say early 70s, yeah.
What I like, though, is it's a great-looking book of all the original scary films, but I like this Theda Barry from 19...
Theda Barra, yeah.
Barra, sorry. Mm-hmm. Sorry, Theda. From 1913, was it?
Yes, the great silent film actress.
Vamping around as a vampire.
Yeah.
Was she draining blood or just sort of more of the sexual vampire?
She was more of the latter, yeah. She was not involved in the stake through the heart thing, but she would, in the use of the term vampire then would mean this unscrupulous woman who would come along and take advantage of men, lure men unsuspecting into horrible situations and drain them of their life force and leave them a shell of what they once were.
All right, we want to get your... scary movie suggestions as well. Some folks have emailed us weekday@kow.org. You can also call us 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869. Let me read you just a couple of emails here, and then I want to go to another scary movie idea that we asked people about. Now, I don't know this movie. Christina in Wallingford at her Chaos Studios, Dogtooth?
Oh, Dogtooth.
Do you know that film?
It's a recent film from Greece.
Scared her.
Yeah, it's a creepy movie. Gets under your skin.
Oh.
It's a film.
No monsters, huh? Just scary, creepy.
Only the humankind, yeah.
Oh,
it's about a very odd family that, as you watch the film, appears to be living in their own isolated, sealed-off world run by the parental unit, and the children don't know anything other than what goes on inside those walls. And it's a very disturbing, really well-made film.
I was thinking about how, for Halloween, CBS was promoting its Criminal Minds show, where a person was doing horrible things to other people. And that's what, on television anyways, that's what's passing for scary, which is, I think it loses the the atmosphere or the reason for why horror movies like Dracula or The Wolfman were created.
You lose that kind of pleasing layer of the supernatural and the stylized.
It's just horrible.
Of, the real, yeah, the, it's funny that the real-life serial killer has kind of replaced a lot of the old goodies.
And yet they're real. I mean, I think about Silence of the Lambs, sort of one of the, it was sort of a crossover. I know it wasn't the first one, but sort of a major crossover for that idea that the serial killer is somebody to be followed, lionized sometimes. Marcia writes, When I saw Wait Until Dark as an eighth grader, my friends and I were waiting for our turn to see the movie in the lobby when we heard the audience scream. We promised ourselves we wouldn't scream or be scared. Well, when that part came, I was on the floor, terrified. Still can't watch that movie.
Yeah, I think that movie had that effect on a lot of people. There's a few moments in it that are really frightening.
All right, and this is from Sally. Hey, I thought you'd like to know, my husband's uncle, Marcel Vercoter, was a special effects guy in Hollywood who did the special effects for The Exorcist, as well as other movies, McCabe and Mrs. Miller. The green, gleeky, gicky bile was split-pea soup, and the room that looked chilled with their breath showing was air-conditioned. Among the few secrets my husband was told.
Mm.
That's a good one.
Worked on both The Exorcist and McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Yeah,
that's
how do you
sort
like
of
that?
Fascinating. But yeah, The Exorcist certainly has legendary special effects going on there.
All right, for Katie Sewell, images from The Ring are burned into her brain. It's probably not the scariest movie she's ever seen, but the pictures are most vivid. Here's a little clip from Ring.
Have you heard about this videotape that kills you when you watch it? You start to play it, and it's like somebody's nightmare. And as soon as it's over, your phone rings, and what they say is, you will die in 7 days.
Well, you know, that in a way, that that is goes back to this Wolfman idea, because especially when we're young, we like to get scared by things that have a very complicated backstory. Like, this really happened, and this could happen, and if you do that... If you say somebody's name 3 times, or if you watch this videotape, or whatever it is, you know, something bad is going to happen to you. Something. And The Ring is, that was a snippet from the Hollywood version. It was one of those Japanese horror films that came along in the last 20 years, which really terrified people. And it just had this great idea, this VHS tape, when watched, could unleash, you know, something awful in your life.
Didn't Bart Simpson call? Oh no, it was the South Park guys. They called forth the Biggie Smalls, I believe, by saying the name 3 times in the mirror, and that was scary. Kirk's in Federal Way. Hi, Kirk. How are you?
Excellent.
Now, Genesis 2. I don't even know this film. What is this film?
Well, it was completely worthless. It was a 1973 TV pilot, and it's completely unmemorable. Except in the show was a device called a stim, and it had a +10 that could kill with pleasure or a -10 that could kill with pain. And the mutants who had enslaved humans used the stim to train the humans, and there's a scene where the hero of the movie is being courted by the mutants to get their nuclear weapons going, so they've surrounded him with beautiful human girls who beg him to let them do something to make him happy. And that prospect of human will being completely eliminated by a pleasure pain device, such that we would beg for the chance to give ourselves completely to another's pleasure, it terrified me then, and when I like lie in bed in the dark and think about it, it terrifies me again.
Wow, that's great. By the way, written by Gene Roddenberry, produced by Gene Roddenberry, starring Alex Cord and Mariette Hartley, two of the big TV stars.
Mainstays of the 70s.
Of the 70s.
I remember when that was on. I watched that.
Were you as frightened as Kirk was?
Didn't make that big an impression on me, I'm afraid, but yeah.
Kirk, you're going to be inventing that now, perhaps. All right, I appreciate that, Kirk. Thank you. All right, scary movies. Movies that really scared you. That's a good one. Just the concept itself.
The stem.
Ripped him. Hmm. Stem. Ben, on Finney Ridge, what scared you?
Yeah, late 70s I watched it, but it was a 1974 movie called It's Alive. And as a relatively new father and another one on the way, it's about a killer baby. And the most powerful scene, I was probably eight, most powerful memory was when the milkman delivers the milk and suddenly disappears from sight, and out comes the dribble of blood and milk combination. It's a terrible movie, but it scared the life out of me.
That one little bit. See, that's what those guys are hoping for when they make those films, huh?
Just one. If you can get a couple of good things in there, you got it made.
All right.
They had TV commercials for that, for It's Alive, which is actually, it's kind of a smart horror movie in some ways. And the TV, I don't remember the name of the family in the film, but the tagline on the commercial was, "There was only one thing wrong with the Jones baby. It's alive."
God.
And that one kind of chilled you to your bones.
All right, Ben, thank you for that. That even the tagline has chilled me a bit. And Jessica on Capitol Hill, what was the scary movie for you? Hi. What was scary for you, Jessica?
When I was a child, I think the most terrified I was of the movie Something Wicked This Way Comes, and it was originally a Ray Bradbury novel.
Yeah.
But also just, a weird Disney children's movie that was pretty scary.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do you remember that film?
Oh, yeah.
I remember the story. I can't remember
I loved the book when I was a kid, but then by the time the movie came out, I was grown up, and so it didn't do anything for me.
Really?
Yeah, the movie didn't
well. It got Jessica. What was this? Is there a particularly scary part you remember from that, Jessica?
Well, basically, it's like the child's worst nightmare. A carnival comes to town, and all of the people start disappearing. Some of them get younger, and basically, it's also a good story about kind of a boy and his father and their relationship. But I believe Pam Grier even was in it. The actress who played Foxy Brown, just as kind of like a scary, non-spoken part. Just the creepy carnival aspect, I think as a kid, everybody like identifies with that.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. The creepy carnival always gets you.
Absolutely. It was in jars.
Jonathan Pryce, Diane Ladd, Jason Robards. Ray Bradbury wrote the screenplay for it, too.
If you love the book, which I definitely did.
Pam Grier, there she is.
Yeah, it
was the Dust Witch.
Okay, I remember Jonathan Pryce as he's kind of the ringmaster of the carnival.
Mr. Dark,
a very disappointing movie.
Oh, yeah?
Mostly because I really had great memories of that book.
Well, scary movies, scary movies. All right, we asked Brian Bucklew, our producer. He actively avoids scary movies, but he would pick Children of the Corn because he lived on a cornfield growing up. Here's a little clip from that.
Every child is afraid of the dark, the nightmare. In Gatlin, Nebraska, that nightmare is in the corn.
Wow. That gets the point across.
Yeah, well, the nightmare's in the corn, man.
They're afraid of the dark and they're afraid of the corn.
Well, and if you're living out there, a movie like that?
But if it's Halloween, are they afraid of candy corn?
That's just terrible. I'm sorry, I had nothing for you.
I guess not.
I had nothing for you.
Well, trick or treat.
All right, and Amina. Amin Al-Sadi, our producer, for her, The Exorcist. Here's a little clip from The Exorcist.
There are no experts. You probably know as much about possession as most priests. Look, your daughter doesn't say she's a demon. She says she's the devil himself.
I'm telling you that thing upstairs isn't my daughter.
Wow. That was a scary movie.
It is a frightening movie. And I can tell you that for me, the few things that actually really scare me, because I don't believe in anything supernatural, the few things that actually scare me in movies are crazy people and possession of some kind. So this weird, I think I'm afraid of like that loss of self somehow. That is sort of scary to me.
That's good. I get that point.
Yeah, transformation.
Yeah.
Well, even werewolf is a little bit like that too.
Yeah, because your loss of self. That's interesting.
Transform into something else beyond your control, I guess.
I guess that's why I find the movies like Saw to be not fun or scary, because the scary part of those movies is your helplessness.
Yeah.
You're trapped, you can't move, and then somebody's going to do something heinous to you. that's just, I mean, there's a level of horribleness that is not, doesn't challenge me as a, a thinker the way loss of self or what our guest was talking about with the stem and what happens with free will.
Yeah. Yeah, so those become kind of mechanical, definitely, after a while. They hew so closely to a formula.
All right, two more quick calls here, and then we'll be done. Melissa's in Wallingford. Hi, Melissa. What was scary for you back in the day?
Hi. The original The Haunting from the 1963, I believe.
Yes.
Yeah, there was a remake that was done of it, but I thought the original was fantastic in its subtlety and how it kind of built. It was about a haunted house that these psychics are brought to kind of do some investigation work after it has a history. And I just thought it was fantastic in how, you know, even the simplest thing, like this woman is sleeping at night and she wakes up and she hears this banging in the halls that kind of come closer and closer to her door, and then the door handle rattles or turns, you know, and she doesn't really know what's happening. I just thought it was brilliant.
Wow, and good actors in that film. Julie Harris, Claire Bloom.
Yeah. I think anytime you have this conversation, you never go more than 15 minutes before somebody mentions The Haunting.
Well, what does that tell you?
It's just a successful film.
It
really
huh?
hits you. And it's got it is kind of elemental, like sounds down the hallway and doors moving a little bit, all that kind of good stuff. The remake was terrible.
Terrible?
Terrible, even right. by the standards of remakes.
See the original. Russ Tamlin was in the original.
Mm-hmm.
Russ
yeah.
Tamlin, one of my favorite unknown actors.
West Side Story.
Yeah.
Rusty
yeah.
Tamplin, yeah.
Yeah. All right, Tom in West Seattle, you get the last word here on this before I ask Robert a question, but Jaws is not considered a horror film, but yet it works for you.
Well, Jaws also, I mean, it just had such a pan-cultural impact. I mean, it really, I think it was a visceral fear, and I was into sharks when I was a little kid. And my old man, I was begging him to take me to see it, and he said, "Don't tell your mom." And we went and saw it. We were supposed to be going to see Grizzly Adams, and we ended up seeing Jaws. And I thought that shark was going to come up through the floorboards in our house. I was absolutely terrified.
Yeah.
We did a lot of salmon fishing out in Seabeck, out in Hood Canal, and I spent the whole summer looking over the edge of the boat.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Tom, thanks for that. Nice image, too, going out to Seabeck. Lawrence writes, "I've always been afraid of only what seems possible, not monsters. I saw Horrors of the Black Museum and Drive in it when I was 10. The opening scene when the unexpected gift of binoculars is delivered, recipient takes them to the window to try them out, seem possible and horrible at the same time."
Yeah.
And oh, that's from Lawrence. And Walter writes, "I too was scared by the Wolfman, Lon Chaney Jr. One of my brothers made me watch it, held me so I couldn't get away."
Yes, that happened. That was known to happen.
Have you seen any effective modern scary films that we talked about The Ring, that one was kind of good because the idea of the possible of the VHS. Anything else, or do you still reach back to the Lon Chaney's and the Bela Lugosi for entertainment, I guess, as much as being frightened?
Yeah, I like the classics, I guess. I don't know, it's hard, it's tough. I haven't seen too many lately that have really scared me, although I saw one last year and I wish I could think of the name of it. It was one of those found footage movies, which are very big in horror right now, of everything is, you know, from the perspective of a camcorder or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And it was about a possession and about a fraudulent, I guess he's a preacher or something like that, who goes to cure this young woman. And that one kind of worked.
Huh. Well, maybe somebody will remember.
Oh, somebody will.
All right. We got a lot of great suggestions for scary movies. Who goes there? Invasion of the Body Snatchers, House of Wax, 3D with Vincent Price, either Dr. Giggles or The Ice Cream Man, The Witches, Westworld for a scary movie. All right, Robert, be safe tonight.
Thank you.
Be very
you
safe.
Too. You too.
This is Weekday.
We have clouds and showers, 56 degrees in the U District. We're expecting clouds and rain the rest of today, the high reaching 58. Same for tonight and tomorrow. Clouds and rain, tonight's low 51, tomorrow's high reaching 57.
Support for KUOW comes from Bainbridge Lodging Association, with 22 members offering a range of accommodations from privately owned hotels to suites to B&Bs for a weekend getaway on Bainbridge Island. Descriptions online at bainbridgelodging.com.
At one time in your life, six was mysterious, and six was an abstraction on par with something like truth and justice. That is, it's in the same Platonic realm that those lofty concepts are. And so, you know, that's a kind of interesting thing. Where do numbers live?
Steve Strogatz talks about the links between math concepts and pop culture. Hear more tomorrow night at 8 o'clock.
Support for KUOW comes from Hillside Student Community School, dedicated to cultivating critical thinking, creativity, and the courage to take risks. Grades 5 through 12, college prep, small classes in Bellevue since 1969. Open house Thursday, November 8th. More at hillsidesc.org.
It's 10:45. I'm Andy Hurst. This is 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information.
All right. Now Michael Parks is here, writing at MichaelJParks.com. What was the line you said as you came in?
Scary economic statistics to go with scary movies.
That's right. Just right for Halloween. Which are the scary economic statistics? Because I've mostly seen some less than scary ones.
Actually, it's less than scary. I've been characterizing the economy as operating a little above stall speed, but not fast enough to get us up to cruising altitude. Lately, I will say, if you go through the economic statistics, you can see us tilting up from stall speed and less at risk of crashing into the runway. We had new data on GDP last Friday, the first run at third quarter GDP, annual rate 2.0%. That compares with 1.3% in Q2. I did the math for the last 12 quarters, so a rolling 12-quarter average. We grew about 2.2% through September 30th, and that was the best rolling 12-month period since the quarter ended in March of 2011, so the best quarter in six quarters. Consumers made a major contribution. Consumers in the third quarter stepped up their spending, especially for durables, things like cars and appliances. There is always a fly in the ointment, however, and the economist Ed Yardeni points out that the federal government spending increased by almost 10% in Q3, and that accounted for about 7 percentage points or 7-tenths of a percentage point of that 2.0 point increase. Without the federal increase, Q3 would have been a very lackluster 1.3%.
Where did the federal government, I don't know if you know this, but where did the federal government increase its spending?
In defense. Yardeni said mainly it was defense spending, and I don't know if it was related to what's going on in the Middle East or if it was weapons programs or what it was, but it was a big change.
I like Yardeni, and I forgot to read him. I like this little sentence here. The negative spin on the subpar growth from the bear camp is very close to stall speed. So they've been predicting a double dip recession. Now they're licking their chops about the fiscal cliff.
That's right.
Which will certainly cause a recession if it isn't averted. I just like that there are people who are licking their chops about the crash of the economy.
Yeah, there are perma bears out there. There's a fellow.
Perma bears.
David Rosenberg at Gluskin's Chef in Canada, who shows up all the time on Bloomberg, on CNBC, very worried about the kind of the continuing deleveraging in the advanced economies, worried about Europe, from which you just returned recently. That problem is not solved by any stretch of the imagination.
Matter of fact, they were talking today about a decline in the euro and also not just Greece and Spain, but even some of the other Euro countries slipping into stalling, growth.
Yeah, the UK avoided negative growth in Q3, but that was partly because of the Olympics and the Queen's what, 60th anniversary?
Their Diamond Jubilee. I listened to a podcast of some comedians who do great news satire, and their argument was it just goes to show you that we should have the Olympics year-round, and the Queen should always be parading up and down the Thames, even in the rain.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, all right, so you said the consumers had some good news. Well, first of all, but just unemployment's the problem here. It remains a problem.
Yeah, if the Bureau of Labor Statistics can get the statistics out by Friday, we'll get the biggest headline, headline in the period between now and the election, including the number that everybody can remember the first time they hear it, which is the unemployment rate for October. I was thinking in the green room, what if the Bureau of Labor Statistics could not get the data out by Friday because of the hurricane? Talk about conspiracy theories. We didn't have the mother of all conspiracy theories when the unemployment rate comes out on Monday. And it's a little bit lower than everybody expected, and the Jack Welches of this world would come out of the woodwork and cry and howl at the moon that the books were cooked. I said on my blog, and I say on the air, willingly say publicly, I don't think the Bureau of Labor Statistics cooks the books. Part of the decline in the unemployment rate, however, is due to the fact that participation in the labor force has been falling for about a dozen years and now is at the lowest rate in about 30 years. That means that of the people who are of working age, the lowest proportion are participating in the labor market, are looking for work, are unemployed. A large number of people of working age have essentially dropped out. They've either retired, they have applied and received disability, or otherwise essentially absented themselves from the labor force. And if the participation rate were anything near where it was 10 years ago, the unemployment rate would be quite a bit higher today.
But you're saying this has been an ongoing trend for 12 years?
Yeah. The participation in the labor force began its decline after or about the time of the 2001 recession. And actually, on my website, the first chart today shows the chart of the labor force participation rate. It rose dramatically in the 1960s and the 1970s as women came into the workforce. I think the high point was about 67% of people of working age in the labor force. Now we're down to, I think, about 63.5%. And one way of thinking about that, Steve, is that there's a lot of production and output that's not being created. It's output foregone. It's kind of, in a sense, it's the same impact as a recession. It's people who are not producing. Obviously, they're consuming because they have to eat and they have to house themselves and they have to clothe themselves.
We're back to the structural questions again.
This is very much a structural question about the economy. And I think it applies as well to other advanced economies, not just the U.S. economy. But if you read broadly on this question of labor markets, there is no question that there are very important structural changes taking place in the labor market and in the economy that go beyond the policy questions that we argue about all the time, such as how big a government do we want, how much interference by the government do we want in the economy.
Well, that's why when presidential candidates say they'll create jobs, I mean, what they're really talking about is they can't.
Politicians cannot create jobs. And I can't help but chuckle when I hear either presidential candidate or any other candidate, including a candidate for governor, who says, I will create so many million jobs. It's not possible.
But they can try to change government policy. I mean,
they change the policy.
Focus maybe, on the internet was a good example.
Maybe they remove some uncertainty from the economy. One obvious thing in the third quarter GDP numbers is that business has gone on strike. So investment in non-residential structures has flatlined, and business investment in equipment and software is actually contracting. So we have these. Now, we always have uncertainty, but I would argue that the uncertainty level is especially high right now because we don't know as so basic a thing as what withholding taxes are going to be on January 1st. Everybody assumes that we will not go off the fiscal cliff and the current reduction in withholding taxes will be extended, but nobody knows. It will be up to the lame duck session of Congress after the election.
May I play my uninformed voter conspiracy theory question? I understand there's always uncertainty.
Oh, sure.
Businesses are sitting on a pile of cash. Businesses shouldn't care, should only care about whether consumers are spending. But is there enough power in some of those businesses and the piles of cash they sit on that they're elevating the sense of uncertainty in order to promote a Republican candidate?
It's a reasonable conspiracy theory, and as a lover of conspiracy theories, I can't give you a great argument on it. But I can argue that in Obamacare, we still have hundreds of regulations and rules that have to be promulgated under Dodd-Frank, the re-regulation of the financial industry. Again, hundreds of rules that have yet to be written and promulgated, and that those uncertainties certainly contribute to businesses' unwillingness. Questions about what tax rates will be. I can't help but chuckle. Every time I hear, it's usually a Republican candidate, say we have the highest corporate tax rates in the developed world. What they don't say is that most of those corporate taxes are avoided by all sorts of means, including offshore earnings, corporate tax rates of various kinds. The effective corporate tax rate is far below the 35% corporate tax rate. So,
well, maybe we'll see all those people pull together after the election and actually do what they want to do with the tax code, which is to, again, trim it, prune it,
sure,
and simplify it.
There's a Democratic Wall Street banker whose name is Roger Altman. Mm-hmm. Who has been writing in the Evercore Partners. He's been writing in the Financial Times. At the end of August, he had an op-ed, What Could Go Right? And his fifth point, he had 5 points, see if I can remember them, reshoring, banking. But one of them was fix the fisc. And he said that the politicians will get together after the election, come up with basic tax reform, and get the problems of the fiscal problems that face us all, get them off the table so we can get back to the business of America, which is business.
All right. Well, we'll see.
Some people wonder, by the way, what Roger Altman is smoking. Mm-hmm. But he does make a persuasive case. Makes a persuasive case that there are positive things to think about in terms of the economy going forward.
Take 2 minutes here to talk about what a huge last couple weeks it's been for Microsoft.
Boy, can you think of a more important month? We've got this new operating system, the most fundamental change in the operating system in 17 years. And not one flavor, but several flavors, including a flavor made to run on the chips that are used today in handhelds and mobile phones. Yesterday, we got the introduction of a new Windows 8 phone. And, of course, last week, the introduction, momentous introduction of a device, a handheld device, a Surface, so-called Surface computer, where Microsoft is going to compete with Apple, with the Kindle, with Samsung handheld devices. There's an awful lot on the table for Microsoft. I will say that the Surface got mixed reviews. Walt Mossberg at the Wall Street Journal said if you're looking for a productivity tool, you'll get more productivity than you would from the iPad. David Pogue at the New York Times loved the hardware, but said it fell down in terms of the software. Windows 8, the operating system, though, has met with a lot of skepticism online. One of the most telling lines came from the editor of the MIT Technology Review. He said, you as a Windows user, when you sit down in front of a new Windows 8 computer, you will see nothing that you recognize. You're going to have to start over. These tiles flashing with current information. And as the New York Times noted on page one last week, a new Windows, but where's the start button? No start button in Windows 8. It's going to take some time to get used to.
All right, well, we will see. We will see. And we see how it affects Steve Ballmer and his chances to support to have support to run that company.
Steve Ballmer, who told the Wall Street Journal this week, I'd like to work into my 70s, and I will stay here as long as I think I can make a contribution and as long as the board is happy with my work.
Michael J. Parks writes at michaeljparks.com. Thank you, sir.
Good to be here, Steve. Thanks.
Thank you for being here. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Darkness falls across the land. The midnight hour is close at hand. Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize your neighborhood. And whosoever shall be found without...
Stick around for NPR News coming up next.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting Dance Theater of Harlem, performing the world premiere of Far But Close and Contested Space, choreographed by Donald Byrd, November 16th and 17th at the Moore Theater. Tickets available at stgpresents.org.
Republican Alan West has called House Democrats members of the Communist Party.
Take your message of enslaving the entrepreneurial spirit of the American people.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.